So first, I just want to thank the Gottliebs for graciously hosting us tonight, and as usual to Ellie for helping us organize and Pesach in absentia. I was stuck in Hamilton. Okay. So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Jonathan Ziering. I'm the Scott and Rosh Beit Midrash of the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzvah Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. Don't try to remember it. It's okay. Rachel Chiner is over there. Adam Friedman over there, Yaron Peretz over there. Okay, so what I want to talk about tonight is the Tanakh Revolution. You can thank Reiter Chiner for the fancy title, Reclaiming Torah or Trojan Horse for Secularism. And Ellie told me that there's a machlokas about which one I think it is, so that's good. So what are we even talking about with the Tanakh Revolution? So basically, for different historical reasons, Tanakh has often been understudied in the Jewish community. We know that as far back as at least the 9th century, the Gaonim write about it. Rabbeinu Tam writes about it, how in Ashkenaz nobody learned, nobody really learned Tanakh, or at least it was understudied. You find evidence of this again in the Achronic period. And the truth is you often have explanations of it. The Nodav Yehuda has a piece where he argues that you should avoid Tanakh because it was taken up by the Reform movement, and often that was part of the problem. It was taken by the Karaites in the Middle Ages, but for whatever reason, Tanakh has often been understudied historically. But in the last 30-40 years, especially in Eretz Yisrael, there's been a real renaissance of Tanakh study. Much of it has happened in my alma mater, in Yeshivat Har Tzion, in Gush. But really throughout Israel, there's been an attempt to reclaim Tanakh, not just to learn it again, but to approach it with new methods, literary methods, to embrace some of the methods from academic study, whether it be historical, archaeological, archaeological finds, comparative law from the ancient Near East, and I want to really analyze this movement, some of its assumptions, maybe a bit of what it is, its assumptions, the potential problems with it, the arguments that arose about it. And to then bring it down to our own learning of Tanakh. Because one of the things that has come is not just a beginning of learning Tanakh again, but specifically learning Pshuto Shel Mikra, of reapproaching the text with new eyes. So not just committing ourselves to learning Tanakh, but committing it to learning the simple read of the text, whatever that means, but meaning not primarily through the lens of Midrash, through the lens of Chazal, and often not even through the lens of the classical commentaries, even the Pashtunim. And that's really created a lot of controversy in Israel. So I want to try to deal with some of the questions that come up, and then sort of talk about some of the implications in terms of how we actually learn. Okay, so at first I just gave you a bit of a summary of what's going on from Rav Amnon Bazak, who's one of the Ramim in Yeshivat Har Tzion, and a very prominent teacher and commentary on Tanakh. And he writes that over the last few generations we've witnessed a heartening phenomenon, a renaissance of Tanakh study amongst Jewry in general, and in the Batei Medrash of the religious Zionist public in particular. After hundreds of years during which Tanakh study occupied no place of any significance in the curricula of yeshivot and other educational institutions, it has now become an integral component to every stream within the Israeli educational system. The return to Tanakh study has also included a return to engagement with the pshat, the plain or literal meaning of the text, and has led to the exploration of profound and fascinating new layers of the text. This process is, of course, related to the process of the return of the Jewish people to its land, which has led to a broadening of the interest in the concrete and material aspects of the Bible, with hikes through different parts of the country and familiarity with the archaeological remains of the past. And part of what drove this is that the return to Israel inspired people to learn Tanakh, because it is the land of Tanakh, and this was true not just in the religious community, this is true across the broader community. Ben-Gurion wrote a perush on Tanakh. You can find it online. You can look it up. He wrote a running commentary on Tanakh. that always gets surprises. He wrote a commentary on Tanakh. What?
We're dumbfounded.
Yes, but he did. He did. Begin was known for his knowledge of Tanakh. During the strike on the nuclear reactor in Iraq, Nosirak, he apparently, as it's told in his biography, he didn't look at the military report the entire time. He just paced, saying Tehillim Baal Peh for the whatever it was, like 3 or 4 hours that the entire operation took. Tanakh in general has been embraced by the Israeli community because it is the land of Tanakh. For secular Zionists, it was a good book to look at because it talked about a world where we fought wars and we lived in the land.
The likes of Ben Gurion took it up, pushed it more to the unacceptable in the right-wing circles.
That is true, and that was perpetually true. That was true in the time when the Karaites took it up. That was true when the Reform took it up. And you're right, it was true at the beginning of the state as well. But the religious Zionist community has also taken it up in a different way, but has taken it up. And now, you know, the sort of the newest iteration of it is, for people who are aware of the 929 phenomenon in Israel. Anyone know? Okay, some people know what it is. 929, Rabbi Benny Lau, along with the Department of Education, felt that it would be proper for the 70th Yom HaTzma'ut to have a national Siyum HaTanach. Therefore, we created a program, 929, for the number of Prakim and Tanakh, where every day a Perek is learned, there's a website for it, and every day there's commentary from across the spectrum in Israeli society, from religious thinkers to politicians to artists to whoever it might be, often some classical stuff and some chutzpahdik material, right? Counterreads of Tanakh, people have problems with Tanakh, it's everybody, right? It's not just people who are in favor of Tanakh, it's not just people who accept it as a religious text, but everyone, because he thought it was important that this be a conversation in Israel. And there are large swaths of the community that have therefore taken it up again with new methods. You see Tanakh tours and the like in Israel. And that's also created a lot of controversy. Because especially some of the new methods have come under attack for many reasons. Let me summarize some of the issues that have come out. First, let me summarize the methods that have been introduced, and then we'll talk about I'll summarize some of the concerns, and then we'll go through them point by point. So, one of the sort of biggest new methodologies introduced is the literary study of Tanakh, approaching Tanakh as literature, right? Using literary analysis, right? Analyzing the structure, parallels, the right, different literary structures you may have, chiasms, right? I knew Ellie was going to do that. Right, a chiasm, right, which is just the Greek letter K, right? It's like an X, right, where it's structured, you know, where one pasuk has a theme, and then a pasuk, you know, 10 pasukim later has another theme, and then, you know, it's A prime, B prime, until you come to the center, which is the theme. Sometimes you have it in entire books. Like in Megillat Esther, the entire book is one giant chiasm, and analyzing that is often important. So if you look at number two, Dr. Yoni Grossman writes as follows. He says, all students of literature, including students of biblical literature, know that a literary text can be examined at different levels and different depths of meaning. He said, the assumption of this whole movement is that the Torah, like any book of literature, but more so, can be understood at multiple levels. Why would you do that? Right? Why is it that any book is understood at multiple levels? Why don't you just, anything you want to say, why don't you just spell it out? Right? Why is it, right? All books get analysis of them, right? It could be sort of, it could be Shakespeare, it can be Harry Potter, right? The number of websites you have on trying to figure out the multiple levels in Harry Potter, right? So it's any work of literature. Why is it that literature doesn't just tell you everything and wants you to analyze it? Okay. So he suggests two things, right? He said, one, is that it allows the reader to become full partners in the process of interpreting the narrative and bringing out its meaning. It forces the readers to engage with the text, right? If you tell the reader everything, then they don't actually have to spend time thinking about the text. And a good book, even the best book, right, requires you to think about it. And the second, is, you know, just theologically, we like the notion that Tanakh should have multiple levels. Right, he writes here, he said, more important than this is the ideology which is at the basis of this subtextual method. The idea that a sequence of events can be explained on different levels, that is possible not only to tell a story in its own right, but to accompany it with subtle concepts, carries within it a religious message which is intimately connected to the meaning of the narrative. Their reality in and of itself demands explication and thoughtful analysis because real events may have a significance beyond what is readily apparent. Right? More important is that Tanakh also tells stories that happened. But reality also has multiple levels to it. Right? That's important, right? You know, to take a very simple example, right? Last week's parsha, right? There are two completely different stories that are going on in Shemot. Right? This is just pshat. It is the story of the beginning of the Exodus of the Jewish people, and it's also the story of Moshe's personal journey, right? Personal maturation into a leader, right? You look at the parsha. Which of those is the main element in the parsha? It's not clear, right? They're both happening simultaneously. You're watching Moshe develop, you're watching the Jewish people develop. And the truth is that if you look at the two haftarot that are read, Parshat Shemot, by Ashkenazim and Sephardim, there seems to have been a machloket between the Ashkenazi and the Sephardi community, which was primary, because the Ashkenazi haftarah is from Yechezkel and talks about God redeeming the Jewish people, and the Sephardi haftarah is from Yirmiyahu, which talks about the process of Yirmiyahu being chosen as a Navi. Right, but the fact that the same story has two levels, the personal level where you can talk about a personal religious growth and the national one, tells you that every story has multiple levels happening simultaneously. And you can't just spell it out clearly in distinct units. Right? This is the story of Moshe's life. This is the story of the Jewish people's redemption. Right? You know, reference back to Moshe's life, you want to know how he fit into it. Stories of multiple levels simultaneously. That's life, and therefore that's going to be Tanakh. That's going to be any story. And for sure, one is important as Tanakh. More importantly, though, is the assumption that Tanakh is a book that can be analyzed this way, which is not obvious, right? Because even though, you know, you'd want to say that if any book can be read in multiple levels, Tanakh should be also the next step, which is we should therefore use the methods that we use for other books to study Tanakh, already gets a bit controversial because it's Tanakh after all, right? It's the Word of God. Why should we analyze it? Well, like we would analyze any book, maybe it has its own methods in and of itself. So as these new methods were emerging, and among them were, like I said, the literary method, but there were more controversial ones. Mordechai Breuer introduced what was known as Shitat HaBchinot, which was the theory of, I don't know how to translate into English, of elements. I think they translate it as the theory of elements, which basically accepted the basic presumptions of biblical criticism, that there are multiple documents in the Torah. He just said that God wrote all the documents, but it's true that there are actually multiple narratives going on in the story that present different perspectives, and the truth is taken by understanding all the perspectives, but therefore we should read the Torah as a Bible critic would, just viewing each book, J-P-E-N-D, as works of God and try to figure out what God was trying to tell you in such a thing, which was more controversial. And then, like I said, there are people who engage in comparative law, which is controversial, right? Why are you comparing Mishpatim, the Code of Hammurabi, right? That's implying, maybe, that Torah law is not unique, is not sui generis, right? That raised controversies. Then there were the controversies over, often, the literary methods. They don't have to, but often they view the Avot in more human terms than the Midrashim would. Right? In Midrash, characters tend to be oversimplified. Good people become better and bad people become worse. But if you read the Pshat, that often doesn't happen. Good people become
complicated.
And bad people also become complicated. So, for example, right? Esav. What sins is he guilty of according to Pshat? When?
Oh,
I'm saying, according to Pshat, that's my point. According to Pshat, what sins does he do? He wants to kill his brother when he's angry with him, but then when he actually meets his brother, what does he do? He kisses him. And without Midrashim, is that a real kiss or is it a fake kiss? We don't know, but it could very well be a real kiss. And we tend to assume that the 400 men he has with him are going to war, but we don't know that's true because he never says that when they meet each other, right? That's in Yaakov's head, but in the Pshat it may not be, right? You can read Esav as a pretty decent character, maybe not great, but there's no indication he did anything particularly criminal. You look at Chazal, what does he violate? Just the day that he comes back to get the soup, what does he violate? Right, the big three, right? Idolatry, murder. So Chazal, right, the Midrash, simplifies the story. And, you know, take David, right? The Midrash simplifies the story. David is good. David never sinned. You read the Pshat, right? He committed adultery, right? Now, again, you without getting to whether how you understand the Midrash, the point is that Chazal, right, Midrashim simplify characters. Good people become better, worse people become bad, people become worse, and Pshat-oriented commentaries tend to complicate people, and this also raised controversies. You know, there was a particular incident where Rabbi Spitz told me this. Yair Spitz, if you remember from the, if anyone knows, he was the principal of the school of Or Chaim till last year. That when he was in yeshiva, he was in the yeshiva of people who opposed the new method of Tanakh study. And you remember that someone came in and told the Rosh Yeshiva one of these new comments that I think it was about the David story, right? That went with the pshat that David committed adultery. And the Rosh Yeshiva's response was about this this Ram and Gush was that, you know, he's clearly right. He committed adultery. And the person said, "Ah, how could you say such a thing?" He said, "Well, how can you say it about David, right? If you get annoyed if I say it about the Ram and Gush, so why aren't you annoyed when people say it about David, right? There is this sort of this intuition that, you know, there's something to the Midrashic method." So this raised a lot of controversy. So that's what I want to do, is I want to go through some of the different assumptions that this movement is based on and challenge them one by one and present the different views and then bring it to what it means for us to learn Tanakh this way. Because, you know, when most schools in North America across the spectrum tend Midrashic, let's say, right? Tend Midrashic. Ellie, it's great to have you here. Like, you're nodding to everything. They tend Midrashic, right? Right? They tend Midrashic. Don't worry, I'm going to push back on the people who are shot oriented also. Don't worry, I'm going to push everything. But, like, it's true, right? Most people, I saw one of the university students played a fun game last week with Monday Night Learning from B'nai Akiva. He threw out random things from Tanakh and said, "Do you know if this is pshat or drash? Do you know if it's in the psukim or not?" He wanted to see if anybody even knew what was in it, right? And the classic is always like, okay, does it appear in Chumash that Avram broke the idols of his father? No, it doesn't, right? Now, what about the fact that the barad had fire in it?
That's pshat.
Good. Okay. Good. A lot of people think that's not right. A lot of people who are very into pshat think that's drash. No, that one's pshat. That one's actually pshat, right? But there are hard ones, right? But people often think that this is right. That this is that the story of Avram breaking the idols is in the Chumash, right? And you know, my kids come home from school, and yes, you know, Parshas Chayi Sarah, right? They come home with candles because of the midrash that Sarah's candles lasted week to week, and therefore Rivka brought that back into the home, and that's what made Yitzchak happy, right? Meaning it's part and parcel. The schools in Israel tend radical pshat, right? They try to leave drash, they leave midrashim out of it. Okay, so what potential problems can arise? So, first problem is that many of these commentaries approach Tanakh not through the eyes of Chazal, right? They don't focus on Midrashim, or they definitely don't interpret the Torah through Midrashim, which, to bring it down even more simply, that means they don't interpret it with Rashi. Okay? Right, let's forget Midrashim. Rashi is often a Midrash-oriented commentary, which means that they ignored the basic things you learned in school when you were reading Chumash and Rashi. Is there a problem with that? So what do you think? Yes or no? Ellie's going to say no. Everyone else? Yeah. No, I don't. Okay. Yes or no? Why would it be a problem to approach?
It depends who you're talking to. Are you talking to the kids in the school? Are you talking to adults? It depends what.
So Joey's already like five steps ahead of me, right? That we're going to get to. It depends. Depends. It's true. What potential problems could there be? You're right. It depends. I'm with you. What potential negatives could there be?
If you start teaching kids.
Personally, I think you have to learn with Rashi. Rashi received a lot of the explanations through Ruach HaKodesh. We don't have that.
Oh, I love this. Great. So very simply, right? One of the things, I mean, very seriously, right? One of the arguments to say you have to read it through the eyes of Midrash, right? Rashi, the Midrashim Rashi quotes is, it's Misora, it's tradition, it's brought from It's brought from Chazal, right? What do you? We accept Chazal on everything, so why wouldn't we just accept Chazal on this, right? That's an argument we at least need to deal with. And to give you an idea of how seriously you could take that, look at the sources. Why do these keep renumbering?
We don't accept Chazal on everything.
Wait, we're getting there. We're getting there. But the argument can be made. Now, at first glance, this is the argument of the Rif, right? Rif Al-Fasi, right? The most prominent, arguably, of the Sephardi poskim ever, except maybe the Rambam, I don't know, or Yosef Karo. Top three, okay, those are top three, okay, but he's pretty important, right? He goes up there in the Beis Yosef's three important people, right? Rif, Rambam, Rush, and, you know, the Rif was the Rebbe of the Rambam, so he's important, okay, important, right, Tertina? He's important, very good. Super important, he's super important, okay? So look at I don't know why this did one again. But okay, interpretation different from Chazal. The Mishnah in Chelek, the last break of Sanhedrin, tells you, these are the people who have no portion of the world to come. The people who say there is no resurrection of the dead from the Torah. The Torah doesn't come from heaven. Vapikaris and heretic. I won't get into the details of it. But these are bad people, right? Deny Torah. Deny Tchias HaMesim, deny the fundamentals. Rabbi Kiva Omer Afakari B'Svar Machitonim. Rabbi Kiva includes of it even people who read books, external literature. What is this external literature that's up there on denying Tchias HaMesim and denying the Torah is from heaven? So the Gemara tells you in two, Tana B'Sifrei Minim. These are the books of the heretics. Rabbi Yosef Omer B'Sifrei Ben Sira, Nami Asur L'Mikra. It's also the book of Ben Sira, which was an apocryphal work. Okay, the Rif in number three writes as follows. Tana. What is this? Bisvarim Shapershu HaTorah Nevim Uksuvim Alpi Da'atam. These are books that interpret Tanakh based on their own interpretation. And don't rely on the Midrash. Because that is heretical or tends towards heresy. And wherever the meaning broke off, the sages said the text provides the response, right? Meaning they're obviously wrong, even in the good words or the wise words that they have are forbidden to read. And you read that line, you can easily read that line in the Rif and say, this whole enterprise is forbidden, right? Anything which doesn't take Chazal into account is heresy. And okay, so then I could ask a question. Does he mean this only in halachic terms, or does he mean it even in agadic terms? I'm not sure, but as one of my charusas pointed out, he includes Nevi'im and Ksuvim, which aren't normally halachic sources, which make it sound like it's even like non-halachic areas. Two caveats, though. One is, this is clearly a polemic against Karaites, but that may not mean he doesn't hold by it. Bigger problem. I posted this on Facebook to a bunch of and sent an email to a bunch of rebbeim of mine and professors of mine to ask me what they thought of this passage. One of my friends pointed out that it's not a question at all, because if you look in the Mosadar of Cook, the Mosadar of Cook Rif, which is based on the original manuscript of the Rif, this whole line doesn't exist, right? It doesn't exist. It's just not there. All it says is Sifrei Tzadok. It says the Tzdukim, right? And somebody later, right, interpolated what is Tzdukim, the people who learned Tanakh, not Bederach of Chazal, but he's referring to the Tzdukim. He's just interpreting the words of the Rif. So, the Rif never said this. So, yes, you could very, very much oppose this, but now, of course, you could challenge me, because why am I looking at manuscripts? I didn't. Someone told me. It's not my fault, right? But you could, right? You could say this. On the other hand, you look at number four. The Gemara itself tells you that Ein Mikra Yotzei Midei Pshuto. That even if we accept Chazal, right, or the Midrash, the Gemara itself tells you that there's still a pshat level to the Torah. Now that may mean other things, but we'll take that simply. So is it legitimate? So even if the Rif did say it, which he may not have, the approach of the Rishonim, most of the Rishonim, was to say that we are not bound by everything that the Midrashim say. By which I mean, you're allowed to have your own pshat, definitely in non-halachic sections, and as we'll see, the Rashbam said even in halachic sections. I gave you this in 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, right? So, the Rashbam was the consummate pashtan, Shmuel Bar Meir, the grandson of Rashi. He's the consummate pashtan, and he's quite extreme, and he tells you that even Rashi, right, even Rashi, who quotes many midrashim, didn't think you were bound to interpret Chumash only like the Midrashim. And he says as follows, Gam Rabbeinu Shlomo, Avi Imi, Meir Einei Gola, even, right, Shlomo, Rashi, my maternal grandfather, the light of the exiles, Shepirash Torah Nevi'im Uktuvim, who explained the Tanakh, Natan Lev Lefarei Pshuto Shel Mikra, what he was actually doing was interpreting Pshat, not Midrash. And the truth is, if you look at the early Ashkenazi material, earlier than Rashi, he is less of a Midrashic commentary than any of them. Right? He took much of the Midrashim out, and what does he tell you over and over? Which Midrashim does he include? Midrashim, Shemashvim, Pshuto Shel Mikra, only the Midrashim he felt could be worked into Pshat, which means that he himself didn't think you were bound by every Midrash. He used Midrash heavily, but only the Midrashim he thought worked on Pshat. And Rashbam adds, "V'af ani Shmuel Bar Meir, Chatno Zatzal, Nitvakachti Mo." And I used to argue with him and say even his current commentary was too midrashic. V'hodeli, and he admitted it to me. And he told me, "Shilu hayelo penai." If he had time, I had tzarich lasod pirushim achirim l'fia pshatot hamitchadshim bechol yom. And he would have told me that he would have written a new commentary with even less midrash based on the pshatot, right? The simple read of the Torah hamitchadshim bechol yom, which are renewed and brought out every day. So he tells you that even Rashi didn't think, if you take the Rashbam's evidence, right? Rashbam's testimony is that even Rashi himself, who quotes many Midrashim, if it was up to him, would have rewritten his Torah commentary with less Midrash. Right? That's his grandson. I don't know if it's right or not, but I wasn't there. And the Rashbam is clearly telling you that Rashi told him, right, that even if his commentary was written with Ruach HaKodesh, so, you know, he would have rewritten another one. Now, again, I can't attest the fact that it's true, but the Rashbam wasn't afraid to say it. So, what do you have? At best, right, in favor of the non-Midrash-oriented Perushim, at best you even have Rashi on your side. But at worst, you have the Rashbam saying that the fact that his grandfather was written, right, with Midrashim didn't scare him from writing his own commentary. Right, so at worst, you have a Machloket Rishonim. And it's not just Rashi, right? Rashi, right? And it's not just Rashbam. It's Ibn Ezra and Ramban and Yosef Bechor Shorim, Yosef Kara and Rav Bulgensi and the Chizkuni, right? So they quote Midrashim more or less, right? Some of them not at all, some of them a little bit more, but all of them interpret not only Alpi Midrash. And the Ibn Ezra, right? And the Ibn Ezra and the Rashbam have a bit of a machloket of whether this applies even to halachic sections. The Ibn Ezra felt not. Right, the Ibn Ezra tells you in 6, the Bavura had drash derech hapshat in sarah, that in favor of drash, right, the way of pshat will not step aside for drash. Kishivim panim letarak, there are 70 faces for Torah. Meaning, Chazal are telling you a truth, and there's another truth, that level of pshat, there are multiple levels to Torah, so I will explain the pshat. Rak b'tarot v'mishpatim v'chukim, matzanu shnei tamim l'psukim, but if there are two ways of understanding halachik psukim, v'tameh achad k'divrei amatikim, but if it's halachic, I would never interpret halacha against chazal. The chalila chalila mitarevim atzdukim, right? I can't get involved with that stukim, with the Sadducees or the Karaites in his time who deny chazal on halacha. V'amrim ki atakadam ma'cheshed ha'katuv, who say that they contradict the verses, v'adikdukim, ra kadmenenu haya amet, but what they said was true, v'kol divrayim amet, he'll lead us in truth. He was true. Everything was true. Halacha, I won't do it. The Rashbam didn't care. Right? The Rashbam did not care. He says in 7, right? Yadu v'yavinu yodei seichel kilobadi l'faresh halachot afal pishem ikar. I believe in halacha, don't worry, but that's not my goal in explaining the Torah. I think halacha is right. I think chazal are correct, but that's not my peirush. K'moshe peirashi v'vreishit k'mi'itura mikraot Nishmaim Agadot v'halachot. Right, I believe that from extra words and extra letters you can learn halacha. Miksatan yimsu b'perushei Rabbeinu Shlomi Avim Yizazal. You can just look in Rashi if you want. V'ani l'faresh pshutan shel mikraot bati, but I came to understand pshat. V'faresh adinin v'halachot l'fi derech eretz. I'll explain even the halacha based on their simple meaning. V'afal piche in halachot ikar. The halachot are the main thing. Moshe Rabbeinu halachot okrot mikra. The pshat, the halacha is true. But that, in my parish, I'm not afraid to interpret halacha, right, halachic psukim against chazal. I remember I mentioned this to someone, and he said to me, are you going to tell me that the pasuk about tefillin doesn't mean tefillin? And I said, I didn't say that. The Rashbam said that. Right? The Rashbam says it about big psukim. The Rashbam on, to give you two. Right? One is, right, tefillin. I didn't put it in, but you can look at the pasuk by tefillin. He says, the simple pshat of the pasuk by tefillin isn't tefillin, it's that, vayulot. Right? Means it should be symbolically in your heart, in your mind. That's it. Right? Not tefillin, not physical boxes. He said the simple pshat is that it should be in your heart and in your minds. And number eight, this is probably the more famous one. If I ask you, when does the day start in halacha, night or day? Night. We all know it's at night. Rashbam said, and why do we say that? Because Vayera Vayoker. But the Rashbam tells you, I won't read it inside, but I'll tell you what he says. Vayera Vayoker, we read is it was night and it was day. The Rashbam said that's not what it means. It means, what is Erev? Evening, meaning day preceded it. It was evening, meaning the day ended, which means which came first? Day. And therefore the Rashbam says, in Pshuto Shel Mikra, day comes and then night, which is against everything we do, right? If Rashbam was right, al pi halacha, instead of saying, what time is Shkia, we would say, what time is, right? Netzachama, Shabbos would start, it'd be like fast days, right? You know, we'd wake up early to get everything done before our alarm went off, right? Rashbam, again, halachically, he's a balatosva, right? He obviously believes that halacha is right, but he wasn't afraid to understand the pshat. Again, Chazal, the Ibn Ezra hated this, and nine, in a fascinating letter called the Igeret HaShabbat, he writes about the Rashbam, probably. Says, Hine za perush mate kol Yisrael. I think we can just stop there, right? This commentary is misdirecting all of Israel. B'mizrach u'me'arav gam ha'krovim v'gam ha'rechokim. Those who are close, those who are far. Everybody. Gam ha'chayim, gam ha'meitim. Those who are alive, those who are dead. Right? Ha'ma'amin b'firush ha'kasher ze yinkom Hashem nikmat ha'shabbat mimenu. And he who says that God will take vengeance on him, right? The vengeance of Shabbos will be taken against them. V'koreoto b'kol gadol tidbar. Anyone says it out loud, his tongue should stick to the palate of his mouth, which hasn't happened to me, so I'm okay. I'm okay. Gama sofer vakotevoto, the one who says it, the one who writes it, beferush haTorah zro'o yivosh, the one who writes it down, his arm should, yivosh tiyabesh, his arm should wither and dry out. Ve'eini mino keheh techen, his eyes should be blinded, right? He doesn't like this. Okay. I guess that's a nice way of that, right? But there was a real machlokes, right? The Rashbam is so convinced you're allowed to interpret psukim against Chazal. He said this even halachic circumstances. The Ibn Ezra isn't willing to accept it in halacha, but in non-halachic sections, he's totally with the Rashbam. You can interpret it against Chazal. There's no problem with it. So this was machloket number one that arose. Because obviously the pshat school, they'll tell you, we're following the proud tradition of the Rashbam, the Ibn Ezra, the Ramban, and even Rashi. According to the Rashbam, we are interpreting the Torah as we see it. We're not ignoring them, but we're offering our own interpretations. But those who opposed it, so for example, I give you a number 10, Rabbi Tzvi Tau, is the Nasi, I believe. He never took the title of Rosh Yeshiva, but he's the spiritual leader of Yeshivat HaRamor, and the schools that follow it, known as the Yeshivot HaKav, they're on the line. You're either on the line or you're off the line. Right? That's his philosophy of the world. He hates, absolutely hates, this new school. The only person at Gush he didn't have a problem talking badly about was Rabbi Yehuda Amital, because he was a Talmud of his many years ago. But he very, very much opposed this, and he writes in 10, some people think when you approach the Bible with our human intellect, removing from all holiness and faith with a dry secular academic approach where the scholar stands above the material he is studying. The scholar determines what should be brought close and what should be pushed away. Rav Kook compares this to the distant past when they would look at the moon without a telescope. The moon is very far from us, and because it is so far, people who look at it through with the naked eye thought that the moon is smiling or winking, that it has a person's face, etc. They would worship the moon, sacrifice to it, speak to it. And why would they do all of this? Because of the great distance. So too regarding the holy writings, we are so far away from prophecy that when we look at it, we just read ourselves into it, our intellect, our opinions, our petty concerns. It is like looking at the moon without a telescope. Rav Kook said, what is our telescope? What will allow us to bridge this the great distance? It is faith. Even though we are not prophets, we are privileged to have Chazal, who were closer to prophecy This is crucial to know that via Chazal we can see more deeply. When you look at the Bible with your own two eyes, it's like looking at the moon without a telescope. You don't see the moon at all, just yourself and your imagination. You got to give it to him. He is a good writer. Even in translation, that is fair. That is, you have to appreciate good writing when you see it. That is excellent. Right? But he says, right, who are we to look at the Torah? Right? Chazal were closer. Chazal understood it. So this was machloket number one. And you see, this is not a new machloket. Right? It goes back to the Middle Ages. Right? It goes back to the Rishonim. And you know, I didn't even give you the sharpest ones. Right? The Gaonim were much harsher, right, than the Rashbam, who said we're allowed to look at the Torah without Chazal. There are tshuvot by the Gaonim where they say, of course you're allowed to, because the Perushim of the Midrashim ein ze ela hevel piyem. Right? That's just, you know, just what they said. Right? It's, I mean, literally, it's the breath of their mouths. Right? Meaning, okay, it's not binding. New. Right? That was machloka number one. Two, as I said, is, okay, well, one of the things that often happens when you re-examine Tanakh without Midrashim is the Avot become more complicated people, which is a nice way of saying they become less perfect tzaddikim. Okay? Or, as Rilchon said, they become less petrified statue, ossified statues of petrified piety. Right? Rilchonstein. Of course. Who else say that? So is that legitimate? Can we complicate the picture of the Avot? Or do we have to look at them as perfect, who never sinned, no matter what? Right? In the ethos of Chazals, right? David never sinned. So, look at number 11. Aaron Kotler felt very strongly that we have no right to complicate the picture. Yeah.
Do you know the context in which that was written?
No.
The context that it was written.
I'm glad that the answer to that was you knew what it is. Yeah, please tell me. Yeah, okay. Okay.
No, but it's important to know what who is critiquing.
Yeah.
Because it's such an absolute.
Should we read it first and then you can qualify it?
Because
okay, fine.
There was some leftist secular, I don't know whether they're kibbutzniks or it was written in like pre-World War II. And he was responding to an article written by non-religious leftists. And they were making fun of the Ovos. And that's why
okay.
I can send you the original piece where it was published.
Okay, so I'm willing, you know, I believe you. You please do send it to me.
Okay.
But if you look at it, and, you know, I mean, look at his quote. He writes as follows. When one teaches students a section dealing with the actions of the Avot, one must explain to them that we are not speaking about regular human beings who have character traits and desires. Rather, we are discussing individuals of whom we can in no way understand their level. People devoid of all human desire and internal will, and just as we have no criteria by which to evaluate angels, so too we have no way of evaluating and appreciating the level of the forefathers. Right? Which, again, maybe he's polemicizing, but there are people who take that position without Ron Cutler and just say, we have no right. Right? You read Rav Neven Saul's Perush on the Torah is a good right example. Right, he follows this. Right, he follows a very midrashic view, and he builds up. Oh, I'm coming to that. It's number 14. I mean, don't worry, Joey. Come on. Okay, and look, there is a tradition like this in Chazal. Right, Chazal do say in number 12 that anyone who says that David sinned is mistaken. But on the other hand, right, on the one hand, yeah, it's true there are voices like that. On the other hand, Chazal sometimes criticize the Avot as well. Look at 13. Right, they criticize Yaakov for favoring Yosef. Right, Lola Ma'ali Shana Adam Bino Ben Abanim Shemeshil Mishkal Shnei Salim Melat Shnatan Yaakov LeYosef Yoter Mishar Banav Nidkanu Bavachad, because of a little bit of wool that Yaakov added to Yosef that caused the brothers to envy him, and they ended up in Mitzrayim. And as Joey correctly points out, you might say, well, we can only criticize the Avot if Chazal did, but the Ramban had no qualms about doing. The Ramban in 14 criticizes Avram for lying and leading to Sarah's abduction by Paro. Now, you can say we're not the Ramban, but the response is always, that's true, I'm willing to admit I'm not the Ramban, right? I mean, the Rilchon Sin, I remember someone once asked him, who would you want to be chavrusas with in all of history? And Rilchon Sin, Kedarko Bakoder, said, that's a good question. But we have to analyze the question. You asked me chavrusa, which means not my teacher. Right? It's who do I think I could have a productive chavrusa with. There are certain people that I would love to learn from, but I can never be chavrusa with. Like the Ramban, who I can, you know, I love, but I could never imagine a million years, right, to be at his level. He was an expert in everything. He's amazing. He is. That's true. The Ramban also criticizes Sarah for her treatment of Hagar. Right? He does. Now, you can say we're not the Ramban. That's true. But on the other hand, there's no formal difference. There is a substantive difference between me and the Ramban. But there's no like magic line that says, right, either you draw the line to Chazal or you don't. Right? Because it's going to be very hard because the Ramban does it. So you'll say, okay, only Rishonim. But then Tziv does it too. So, okay, maybe the Achronim. When do you draw the line? Right? When can we stop? So again, this is a, you know, yeah, you know when we stop? Okay. Yeah, when do we stop? yeah, 10 o'clock. Good answer. Yeah.
My two daughters, when she was in Beis Yaakov, when they portrayed the almost like the Ramban Chota, the same thing, but Ramban Chota, and the response was, it's a Shver Ramban.
Okay, you can do that.
But what about Rosh Hashanah Fall Hershey, don't quote on this, where he says, the Torah purposely showed the others with faults.
Oh, okay. Well, we're coming to it. Don't worry. I mean, I put Rehlochenstein for it, and but.
Well, Rehlochenstein's more nuanced position between the two.
Okay, but now the truth is right that there is. It's not just now. What hangs in the balance here? Right, so one is, do we look at the Avot as, you know, perfect beings? But as Lachenstein pointed out in 15, and you're telling me if Hirsch said it in, you know, in a less nuanced, more simple perspective, but there's a cost to overemphasizing the perfection of the Avot, which is they become unrelatable. Right? If David sinned, right, and still managed to do tshuva and still be the paradigm of the righteous king, that's more relatable for most people than yeah. Right, you can learn something from it. It's very hard to say you can learn something from someone who can never make a mistake. Right, so there's a cost to it. Lichtenstein writes this in 15. Right, advocates of hagiographic parshanut, which portrays the central heroic figures of scriptural history, is virtually devoid of emotion, or as Reb Pinchas of Kuritz said, who never spoke any words that aren't found in Chumash. Okay, I don't know. Adam showed this to me. It's true. He writes that. I don't know what it means. Can only regard the sharpening of psychological awareness with reverence and awe with a jaundiced eye. But for those of us who have been steeped in Midrashim, Nachmanides, and Hamek Davar in a tradition that is, with regard to our patriarchal Avot and their successors as very great people indeed, but as people nonetheless, and which moreover sees their greatness as related to their humanity, in humanity enhanced literary sensitivity can be viewed as a significant boon. Meaning there is a benefit. It's not just like, well, why don't we be machmir, right? And only interpret the Avot as pure tzaddikim. Because there's a cost. If Tanakh is meant to speak to us, it's easier to do tshuva when you believe that even Avram Avinu once sinned, or Moshe sinned. It's much harder if the narrative that you tell is every person who was great from the moment they were born. Right? There's a cost to saying, there's a real cost to saying that. On the other hand, I will add a corrective. Some people get over-enthusiastic, and this comes to Joey's point, of criticizing the Avot. And Rav Karmi is one of the greatest writers who is currently alive, and also just one of the greatest writers ever. Look at 16. I can't even begin to say this as well as he does. Here's the problem with being too enthusiastic, right? I'm willing to say we should look at them as not perfect. On the other hand, sometimes it gets into pop psychology, and people have written articles on like, "Ooh, Yitzchak had Down syndrome." Okay, this gets a bit far. So here's how he wrote it. Okay, I just can't do it better than him. At the same time, we must be on guard against a shallow approach where the genuine awe and respect that we feel towards the Avot Ha'umah is compromised by cheap psychobabble or tendentious readings. Striking this optimum balance between honesty to the text, the source and the very religious message of the text, and maintaining an appropriate sense of reverence and respect for biblical heroes is no easy task. And then he criticizes people specifically who aren't worried about this, and like just ascribing the Avot all types of, you know, sins and problems as if they were normal people. One reason that people shrink the larger-than-life personalities of Tanakh to pop psychology size is that they are accustomed to treating themselves the same way. What characterizes pop psychology? Causal deterministic assumptions, cliched depiction of emotion, a philosophy that cannot grasp the dramatic, absolute, momentous solemnity of the moral religious life. That's not the way I think of myself. It's not the way I think of you. It's not the way one should think about any human being created uniquely in the image of God. Once people see nothing wrong in entertaining secular conceptions of themselves, once they take for moral and psychological insight the tired idiom of the therapeutic, it's no wonder that they are tone-deaf to the grandeur of the Avot and Imahot. Right? Which is a beautiful way of saying, don't get carried away with this, right? You can The Ramban isn't saying Avram isn't a good person. He's saying he was a great person who made mistakes and still managed to be Avram Avinu. Right? Don't walk away with this and think that the message is, oh, we can find sins with the Avot and therefore they're not the Avot. They are. The point of this, even if you want to accept the approach that we can look for things that they did wrong, that aren't in Midrashim, that aren't in Chazal, the point is not to downgrade the Avot, but to upgrade, right, their relevance in our lives by recognizing that even great people can make mistakes. But this is one of the things, as I mentioned before, the story of Rav Tau, that he didn't accept at all. Right? He said no. Right? He wants the perfect avot, and the truth is that this ethos often spills over not just into interpretation of Chumash, but into interpretation of everybody, right? All Gedolim, right? One of my teachers in Gush, my Masada Kedushin actually, Rav Schreiber, liked, as the example of the epitome of how far this could get, like bringing in the biography, I believe, of the Manchester Rosh Yeshiva, of Yehuda Zev Segal? Is that Yehuda Zev? Was that his first name? Rav Segal, yeah? Where it has a picture of him smiling in the book with a caption, "A picture of the Manchester Rosh Yeshiva deeply engrossed in Torah thoughts." Right? There is sort of a school of thought that takes that to an extreme, right? There are extremes in both directions. But that was controversy two. Okay. Controversy three. Can you take insights from non-traditional sources? Because, you know, there are people in the academy who are involved in the literary study of Tanakh, right? Like Robert Alter, for example, and we haven't even talked about like comparative law, but their insights you can get from comparative law to Hammurabi, right? They're purely secular or anti-religious people in the academy. Are you allowed to take their insights at all? So again, this was a big machloket, right? Tau again in number 17 does not want you to, and this is why he says, and it's, again, he's a great writer, he says as follows: one who did not believe in the divine origin and sublimity of the words, that they flow from divine truth, that is infinite, absolute, and eternal, one who lacks this faith will not understand the Holy Scriptures whatsoever. He said, if you don't understand that Tanakh is Tanakh, you don't get Tanakh. All of his analysis, all of his investigations, all of his theories, and all of his discoveries fall into the category of nonsense. When all these ideas are missing, when humility and self-effacement are lacking, when these elements are absent, come the scholars, Jew or Gentile, it makes no difference, and search the Holy Scriptures. They raise objections, they erase, they distort, they amend, they suggest theories, they demonstrate creativity, they present novel ideas. What is all this to us? How are we connected to them? We occupy ourselves in the truth of the Torah. We engage ourselves in the holiness of the Torah. One who lacks both the beginning and the end, there's no point in talking to him at all. I don't even need to explain that, right? Okay. On the other hand, there was another voice in Rishonim. So, for example, the Rambam, Shema Ha'emet Mishamra, hear truth from he who said it. Or, if you want a fun story, number 19, Rabbi Yosef Ibn Achin quotes Rav Haigon, and he writes as follows, this introduction to Shir HaShirim: we find in the books of Rav Haigon that he made recourse to the words of the Arabic scholars and made use of the Quran. And such was the custom of Reb Sajja, when Reb Sajja gone before him in his Arabic commentaries. And in this regard, the Nagid, when Shmuel Nagid, describes in his book, after citing many comments of the Christian scholars, that Reb Matzliach ben Albalzek told him on his arrival in Baghdad that one day they were discussing the verse Shemen Rosh, Yani Roshi, in the yeshiva, and a debate ensued as to its meaning. And Rav Hai directed Rav Matzliach to go to the Catholic priest of the Christians and ask him, what does he know about the meaning of this verse? And it was evil in his eye. And when Rav Haizal saw that Rav Matzliach was distraught over this, he reprimanded him and said that the forefathers and the early pious ones who are for us exemplars would inquire members of other faiths about the meaning of words and interpretations. So there is a strong tradition as well of saying, you know what? We can take truth from wherever it is, and it can provide insight for us. We obviously don't take their assumptions about the text, but we can learn from them.
But why do we seek them out? It says go seek it out.
Yeah, because they have insights. You know? Because, right, yeah, the Gemara talks about learning from Arab, from an Arab merchant, about learning from Rebbe's maidservant, right, from everybody. But you see that people did this, right? Big people. Rav Haigon, Rav Sajagon, right? Big people. The Rambam, right? These are big people. Ibn Arbanel does it. Ibn Ezra does it, right? Everyone does it. Well, not everyone does it. Many people did it. Not everyone. Okay. So I focused mostly on literary stuff. But what about archaeology, right? In the ancient Near East. So on the one hand, yeah, often studying them is dangerous because often the archaeologists are involved in trying to disprove the Torah. But sometimes they're not. And sometimes it provides important insights. The Ramban himself, I didn't give you the piece inside, but the Ramban, in deciding where right? Beit Lechem was where, right? Ephrat Beit Lechem was, and where Rachel was buried changed his mind between the Peirush he wrote when he was in Spain and then when he came to Eretz Israel, because sometimes you can't understand things about archaeology, right? That's a easy archaeology, right? Looking at Israel and seeing what it looks like. And even ancient Near East things, right? Like comparing it, which is often what people do, they compare it to literary things in the ancient Near East. Sometimes it provides traditional things. So for example, Bein Einecha, right? We say Tefillin Bein Einecha means over here, right? So you might think, okay, I'll do a Pshat interpretation. Pshat Bein Einecha is here, right? Like the Karaites. But the truth is, if you look at the ancient Near East, there's a story of Baal, who's the rain god, fighting Yam, who's the sea god, and he kills him. And how does he kill him? He kills him by swinging an axe over his head and striking him Bein Einav. Right now, if you swing an axe over your head and strike someone, Bein Einav, where's Bein Einav clearly? Right here, exactly where Chazal say it is. So, a comment on archaeology is, on the one hand, yes, it is sometimes dangerous. On the other hand, sometimes it provides genuine insights that we couldn't have known. I mean, in that case, we just believe Chazal. Okay. But in the case of the Ramban with, you know, Ephrat Beit Lechem, he needed to see it, right? Sometimes you need to see things to fully understanding it. Okay. Two last points here. Is it abandoning the Masorah? So, as Nechama Leibovitz likes to put it, no, it's not abandoning the Masorah, because one must first study Chumash just as Rashi did, without any Rashi on the bottom, right? Learning Tanakh traditionally doesn't necessarily mean jumping to the commentaries. It means learning the Torah as they did, meaning yourself, and then understanding what they were contributing to the conversation. So even if you want to take the Midrashim seriously, or to borrow language from the Trump campaign, the sort of comments on it, take it seriously but not literally, right? You need to first learn the Torah without them to understand what it is they're responding to. And that is traditional. That's not traditional. That is traditional. And also, it's too simplistic to say that that Midrashim are like not Pshat. Often Midrashim are aimed at uncovering levels of Pshat. So, I can't read this all, but I gave it to you in 24, where Moshe Lechonstein tells the story. He said he was once, he had people over for a meal, and he said, they asked him to teach their kids Parsha. You know, we all do this, we teach our kids Parsha at the table. So he started talking about the story of Esav biting the neck of Yaakov and his neck turning to marble, and the mother looked at him horrified and said, "Anachnu rak lumdim pshuto shel mikra." Right, we only learned the simple meaning. And Ramosha said, look, I disagree with that approach for two reasons. One is that who says that Midrash, sometimes Midrash is Pshat, but even if it's not Pshat, who says that that doesn't lead to a understanding of Pshat? The Machloket that Rashi quotes, did Esav in that moment love Yaakov, even though he normally didn't, or was he trying to bite him? Those are really discussing something fundamental in the text, meaning, did Esav harbor any brotherhood toward, right, brotherly feelings to Yaakov or not? And that's a pshat question. It's been dressed up in this story, but often it's too simplistic to say, do I care about pshat or midrash? Often, as Rabbi Bednarz likes saying, the drash of the drash is often omek pshuto shel mikra. Right? If you try to understand what the midrash is getting at, sometimes you'll understand the text itself. Right? So even approaching it through Pshat doesn't mean that Midrashim aren't part of the conversation. The second thing he notes is that there's a reason in younger grades to focus on Midrash. And he said, look, in North America, it may be true that we've gone to one extreme and we want Midrash for everything. But there's a danger with what's happened in many schools in Israel where they've gone to the other extreme and all they care is Pshuto Shel Mikra. And he said that's a problem for two reasons. One is that, well, you know, I'll just put it all together. The problem is that the purpose of learning Tanakh isn't just learning, it's connecting to God. And Midrashim, A, teach us Yirat Shamayim, and B, they connect us to the text. They are more vivid. Right? He said there is, and kids can't always understand nuance. They can't. Right? I can't explain to my 4-year-old, right, so much nuance. It's easy to say that Avram was perfect and build it up and bring nuance later. Right? So there's two reasons to favor Midrash at younger ages. One is that it's easier for them to understand it. It's more vivid. It's, as he said, it's more flat rather than round. Right? The Ramban's complexity and nuance. For adults, we can talk about the avot as being complex. Right? You don't tell your kids, well, your teacher is a nice person, but you know, is a good person, but sometimes they do, you know, some bad things. So, you know, don't say this, it might get them in the wrong mood. Don't scare them, right? If you like their teachers generally, just tell them, don't you have a wonderful teacher, right? We just avoid complexity because they get scared, right? They don't understand complexity. And two is, as he said, midrashim. So to take an example, I would be bothered if my kids grew up without knowing the midrash that Avram broke the idols in his father's house, even if it's not pshat, because it teaches a fundamental lesson. And part of our goal isn't just understanding pshutos shel mikra, it's connecting people to God. And midrashim, even if they're not pshat, are often trying to teach values that are important. So to sum up, right, what we've seen is that, is it legitimate to approach Tanakh not through the eyes of Chazal alone? Again, this is an old machlokas, but there were many voices who said, yes, well, there were some voices who pushed back. Can you even take in non-traditional voices? Again, that's a machlokas. Are we allowed to look at the Avot as not as perfect as they appear in the Midrashim? Again, a machlokas. Again, a machlokas, but what's at stake there is, are the Avot relatable or not? Or do they become these ossified statues of petrified piety? No, don't overdo it, right? Don't say that, well, I can read in more problems into the Avot than are there, and then, you know, overdo it. That's a problem. They are great people. Don't run to the other extreme. We talked briefly about taking in archaeology and the ancient Near East. But the last point, again, which we came back to is, even if you decide, if you're convinced by the end, okay, there's value to approaching it through literary eye because we can come up with new pshatim and it allows us to see a rounder picture of Tanakh. This isn't an abandoning of the Midrashim. First of all, because it's too simplistic to think that the Midrashim aren't just engaging in the same type of analysis, just in complicated ways. Also, even if you think the Midrashim are not pshat, that doesn't mean you shouldn't teach them, because they teach values, and they connect people to Tanakh. It does mean that as you get older, you should complicate the view by adding dimensions. But it doesn't mean that we should give up on the Midrashim, even if you don't think they're pshat, and it's worth studying pshat. We have multiple goals when we learn Tanakh. And now, just to close with just one example. You know, Ellie will like it. I'm sure he saw it last week, right? Ray Foreman, who's one of the few people in North America who really engaged in this, right? For you, right? You know, just on last week's parsha, right? He said, you know, like the midrash of Bat Paro, right? Stretching out her hand, right? And that her hand expanded to get Moshe. He said, it's very easy to read that midrash as saying something profound about pshat. And he said, it's very hard, right? Imagine, you are the daughter of Paro, who sentenced all the kids to death, and you decide that you're going to bring that child into the palace. What would we say in English?
Out of your reach.
It's out of your reach, right? That's what we would say in English. So why shouldn't we give Chazal the benefit of the doubt that that's what they're trying to teach you? Right? You can take the Midrash seriously, but not literally. That's not abandoning Chazal. That's asking the question, what are Chazal trying to teach us? Or to take an example where a Midrash is actually looking at Pshuto Shel Mikra literally. I like using this example. It's a Midrash in Kohelet Rabbah. Midrash says that when Yoshua became the leader of the Jewish people, everyone was scared. I used it in a share this week, so it's on my mind, right? Why? He said, B'pshuto shel mikra, why would they be scared? So the Midrash says, what are the first two times Yeshua speaks in the Torah before he becomes leader? The Egel, where what happens? Moshe says, what do you hear? And he says, oh, I hear war. And Moshe says, you don't hear war, you hear rebellion. And then it's by Eldad and Medad, where Yeshua says, put them in prison. We don't want anyone to be a Navi except for you. And what does Moshe say? I want everyone to be Naviim. So the Midrash says, you know why everyone's scared when Yeshua becomes a leader? Because the only thing they've ever seen him do until this point is make mistakes. Right? That's Pshuto Shel Mikra. But that's a Midrash, right? They just highlight the fact that two times the Torah introduced Yeshua, he made a mistake. Right? Of course they were scared when Moshe died. Right? That's all they ever knew about Yeshua. Right? So Midrash, A, is getting to important lessons. B, is connecting children to text, but often is going through Pshuto Shel Mikra. But what I think is important to remember that just saying Midrashim are valuable, important, even getting to Pshuto Shel Mikra doesn't free us of our responsibility to, as Nechama Levi said, learn Tanakh as they did, without them. Right? To try to engage the text ourselves, engage ourselves with Dvar Hashem ourselves, and see, as the Rashbam said, the Pshatim HaMitchatchim B'chol Yom, the new interpretations that we can have, so we become part of the conversation with Dvar Hashem.